Crowd My Table is a Real Talk production. You can find Real Talk at realtalkproductions.squarespace.com, follow us on Instagram at realtalk.productions, or email us at wearerealtalkproductions@gmail.com.
Hi, this is Holly, and this is Crowd My Table Podcast, a podcast meant to bring people together by discovering beauty in the ugly, creating strength in the broken, and choosing joy in devastation. And today I'm having Emma. She's going to interview me. Mm-hmm. So,
you ready?
Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Okay. I mean, like, personally or professionally?
Whatever, both. Whatever you want to do.
My name's Emma Millett. I produce this podcast. I'm on the production team for this show. And I own the network that distributes the show, and called Real Talk Productions. You hear my voice probably at the beginning of every episode of this show. And I mean, that's my relevance to this show. I don't know if you want to know, like,
yeah, so I just,
who I am as a human.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not relevant. Maybe it's better if I'm just like an inhuman presence just to get details out
right,
of you.
Right, so I had wanted to share my own story, but I'm like, I don't want to just share my story by myself. I want someone to interview me.
Yeah.
And I feel like Emma would be great because she's kind of like an unbiased, like,
yeah,
you know.
I only know a little bit.
Right, so she'll be learning a lot about me,
yes,
as well. So you guys all can learn.
Yeah.
So.
It's going to be good.
Yeah.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's do this.
Okay, let's, before we get into, like, the nitty gritty of, like, your story,
mm-hmm,
let's, like, some foundation work. So I know that there's another episode with your brother where we kind of covered, mm-hmm, some of this, but
yeah,
kind of explain where you're from.
Yeah,
and
so
your family dynamic just a little bit.
Yeah, so I grew up in Mesa, Arizona. I was born in Bakersfield, California, but I was raised in Mesa, and I have one brother and two sisters, and so,
and you're the youngest?
I'm the youngest. Okay. Yep. So I mean, like, my brother and I talk about, we had a really good childhood. It's just kind of a different, you know, we had, I guess, a traumatic thing happen in our family with my dad, and we'll talk about that a,
yeah,
little bit. Well, you guys will hear that episode. But anyway, so after he died, I had, like, major issues with trusting men. And in my mind, I thought all men cheated and all men were addicted to sex and pornography. And
how old were you when he died?
15.
Okay.
Yeah, so I just had a really hard time trusting men. And I was actually going to our church where I had talked to, like, our bishop, and I just said, you know, I really, like, part of me wants to get married, but part of me doesn't.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to end up like my mom. And so he was like, you know what, you need to get into some counseling.
Good for him.
Yeah. So he got me in touch with a lady named Carrie Mon. She's a life coach, and she is amazing. She's in Mesa, so if you need a life coach, she will change your life. She changed my life.
How old were you when you started going?
I was 25.
So 10 years later.
Yeah.
10 years later. And in that time, were you dating?
Not much.
Okay.
I would go on dates here and there, but I served a mission for a church in Chile.
Okay.
So I graduated from high school, and I went to beauty school my senior year of high school, and then I went to EA for one semester because my best friend, who is still my best friend now, was going, and I was like, you can't just leave me. And so I literally took two classes. I took acting and choir.
Excellent.
And I went just for the experience. I wasn't really wanting to go to college. I'd already
it's
gone
to the best
to
place ever.
It's
best
so
place
fun
in the world.
So I just wanted the experience. And so I knew that I wanted to do hair. And that was, like, the career path that I wanted to take. So it was just a fun experience. So I went to EA, and then
did they have a hair school then when you were there?
Not at EA. I went during high school.
But they didn't, and you finished.
Yeah.
So you just did it in 1 year, and you were done with hair school by the time you went to EA.
Okay. So I started the summer before my senior year, and then I graduated from high school and beauty school the same week.
Okay.
So that's what I did, and then, EA was so much fun, and then I decided I wanted to go on a mission, and served in Chile, and then I got back, and, I was a counselor for this program called Especially for Youth. So I was I know. It was a total blast. I did that for 3 years. I was a counselor for 2 years, and then I was a building counselor. So I was like the counselor over the counselors.
That's lived the best Utah. Job.
It really is the best kept secret.
In the whole program of EFY,
it really
being
is.
A BC is 100% the best job.
It really is the best kept secret. Because you get to have the youth and the
grown-up time.
It was so much fun. And that time we traveled. So I did a session. I did Arizona. I did Utah. Vermont.
I did Washington.
Yeah.
I did Tacoma.
Yeah. And Vegas. So it was a lot of fun. But anyway, so I did that. And then I came back to Arizona. And that's when I was like, okay, I need to figure out my issues and get some help here.
What was it that, what was a turning point that caused you to be like, now is the time?
I was at this crossroads. I was like, do I want to, get married and have a family? Or do I really want to take my career to, when I went to beauty school, my goal, I wanted to do hair for, celebrities. Mm. And I wanted to do, hair for, shows and... Mm-hmm. Things like that. So I was like, do I want to do that?
Like what Justin Anderson does.
I wanted to be Justin. Wanted to be Justin Anderson.
Yeah.
And so I live vicariously through him now.
Yeah. Hey, Justin.
Justin, I love you. So if you guys don't know Justin Anderson, he is a celebrity stylist who is the kindest human on this planet.
Mm-hmm. He
has a podcast that we love. And I feel like he's like a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
Even though we've never met, he's like a dear friend. He is so sweet.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so I was at this crossroads. I'm like, what do I want to do? And I just feel like, I felt like my mom had gotten remarried and I felt a lot of anger towards him for some reason. And so I got...
For some reason. It's normal.
Yeah.
We can probably think of a couple reasons.
Yeah. So I just felt a lot of anger towards Tony for,
Did you feel anger towards her?
Towards my mom?
Yeah.
No.
For remarrying?
No.
No. Just him.
Just him.
Did you have
And
issues?
I felt like because he was taking her away from me. Because my mom was my best friend.
Yeah.
And we, from 18 to when I got married, it was just her and I.
Yeah.
And we just had, even, from when I was 15, my dad died.
Yeah.
We were, each other's best friend. So, her getting married, he took her away from me.
Yeah.
So, I was mad.
Did you have issues with, after it all went down with your dad, you had issues with men, and we'll talk about that, but mm-hmm. Did you also have issues with marriage as an entity? Were you sketched out? Is that part of the reason mm-hmm. you were sketched out by him?
Yeah.
Because it was marriage is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I had gone to my bishop and I was like, I think something had happened. I don't even know what it was, but I'd gone into him and I was just like, I just need to figure this out. And he was like, and I told him about my dad and he was like, you need counseling.
Good for him.
So he had mentioned, he'd actually asked if I was molested. And I said no. And he's like, okay, then I know who to send you to.
Who is this bishop? I like this guy.
Bishop Kimball.
Because how long ago was this?
This is in 2006. 2006.
I feel like even now it's hard. There are some religious leaders and multiple religions that have a hard time finding a place for therapy mm-hmm. in having a hard time. And mm-hmm. so that's just really great that he saw enough red flags that he knew to ask more questions and knew where to send you.
Yeah.
Good for him.
So he sent me to Carrie Mon and she's a life coach. But the thing with Carrie is that she has been through everything. So she can relate to literally anybody. She was sexually abused. She has dealt with suicide. She's dealt with cancer. She's dealt with, you know, just so much. And so she is so wise. And she also teaches love and logic classes, which is also amazing. She is, like, I have a special place in my heart for Carrie Mon. And I just love her. Like, I've invited her to live into my house several times. She's turned down the offer because she's happily married. But I'm like, help me raise my kids.
A living life coach.
No, but so I went to her, and this is so fascinating. So we dug into, like, the whole dad situation, and she was like, okay, we're going to do this exercise. And, well, first she had me read a few books. She had me read Leadership and Self-Deception.
Okay.
And The Anatomy of Peace.
Uh-huh.
Phenomenal books.
Uh-huh.
I should read them again because they're so good. So I read both of those. And then she had me do this exercise where I had to write a letter to my dad left-handed. I'm right-handed.
Yes. I remember you telling me about this.
So I had to write with my left hand. And it was like somehow, like, you writing with the opposite hand takes you back to that time.
And it uses a different part of your brain. It uses a
totally different part of your brain.
Yeah.
And so I wrote this letter, and I basically told him that I was mad at him for the choices that he made, and he ruined our family, but I also forgave him. And she helped me see him as a human again, because for so many years I monsterized him in my mind. I turned him into this bad person, that he was just, he didn't care about our family, but that's not the case. Like, my dad was a good man.
Yeah.
You know, he just had some major struggles.
Yeah.
And so she helped me see that again, and she helped me have empathy for him.
Yeah.
And love him again.
Yeah, I think it's really... So, one thing that I... Like, I've been in therapy for a long time. I've done group therapies and things like that. And something that I think gets stepped over, gets skipped over a little bit, is this step where the people who have hurt us... I don't know, and this isn't true about therapy, like, I'm studying to become a counselor, so, like, not all counselors do this, but I think as we are working through our own stuff, sometimes we forget the part where we have to humanize the person that did
mm-hmm.
something
mm-hmm.
to us.
And that's what Carrie does. That's what, she's able to, like, take a situation and, like, have it, like, on this little turntable so you can see all the angles and all the yeah. aspects of it. And then take that person, and, like, she says that sometimes we tend to, like, put people in boxes, and yep. we,
Especially our parents.
Especially our parents, yes. We put them in a box, and we see them as an object and not a human.
Yeah.
And so she helped me humanize my dad.
Yeah.
And
which is hard him. Because it feels like if to humanize the person that hurt you is, it, like, it feels like it's going to invalidate your experience right. somehow.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
But so it true. Doesn't, right? But right. like what actually it's almost the opposite, where, like, because our instinct says, no, if I humanize him, that means that he had permission to do that because he's imperfect, or mm-hmm. that, you know, now I'm validating his experience, which invalidates mine. Mm-hmm. But they can both be valid, and he can still be wrong. Like, mm-hmm. he can still be held responsible for the mistakes he made without having to be defined by them, mm-hmm. and then you also don't have to be defined
right.
by them. By yeah. humanizing him, there's yeah. freedom available to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was life-changing for me. And so at this time, like, I had this whole thing where, like, I did not ask guys on dates. Like, no way. And so Carrie was asking me, like, okay, so is there anyone you're talking to? Is there anyone in the ward that you like, that you'd want to date? And I had just started talking to Matt, my late husband. He lived in Omaha, and I lived in Arizona. And it was, at the time, it was called LDS Link Up. Mm. So it was, like, an online, like, it was more than dating. It was, like, not just for dating. It was, I lost, like, a lot of people used it for, like, almost like a social media before yeah. social media.
Like, trying to fight and track down their people.
Yeah, and, like, and just, you know, hey, I'm looking for a roommate, or hey, there's a party this tonight, you know. Uh-huh. You know, so that's kind of what it was. So him and I connected. It was like, you know, someone new on the page would be like, hey, this is a new person. Why don't you say hello to them? So he saw me and said, hey. So we just kind of just randomly started talking. And
this is while you're still...
This is while I'm in therapy.
Okay.
So, random. And so Carrie's like, I want you to think of two guys who you want to get to know, and you're going to ask them out. And I was like, the thought of it just made me sick. Because I just, it made, gave me such anxiety. So I was like, well, there's this guy named Matt.
Because of issues just like, with men? Or
just like the fear of rejection. And I just didn't, I don't know.
I mean, we could spend an hour just talking about that.
Yeah. So she was like, okay, I want you to ask a guy out in your ward on a date. And then I want you to call this Matt guy on the phone and talk to him.
Wow.
And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So I went to Hawaii with my girlfriends. And so Carrie was like, okay, when you get back from your trip, I won't let you come back to me until you call this Matt guy. And I was like, ah, fine. So I got his phone number, and I knew that he didn't have his phone with him on Sundays. And so I called him on a Sunday. So I just left a message.
Cheater.
Yeah. So he called me back that night, and we talked for like a couple hours on the phone.
Wow.
And it was just like this instant like friendship.
Yeah.
So we just talked like literally all day and all night for like 6 weeks. And it got to the point where we're like, okay, do we want to meet each other? Like, this is so crazy. So he came to Arizona, and it was so weird. It was so weird because he didn't look like how I imagined him and from pictures.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I was like in love with him.
Yeah.
So it was like, nice to meet you. By the way, I'm in love with you.
Right.
You know, it was so weird. So the first visit was good.
Did you tell him that you loved him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over the phone.
Oh, before we met. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, so I have a sign in I'll show you on my laundry room. It's the sign he had made for me for Christmas, and it says we fell in love in over the phone. Because it's supposed to say we fell in love in Arizona, but we fell in love over the phone. So it says we fell in love in over the phone.
That's
and
funny.
It's really cute. So I'll show you the sign.
Yeah.
But anyway.
We'll have to take a picture of it and put it on here.
Yeah, we will. So, so we just talked like literally every day, all day. And so he came out to Arizona in the middle of summertime, so hot. And the first visit was good, but it was kind of weird, but it was like good.
Yeah.
And then he left, and then he's like, I'm coming back again this weekend. Came back again, and we've been better. Like, it was just, I knew what to expect.
A week later he came back?
Yeah. That next weekend he came back. And then we just traveled. Like, the longest we went without seeing each other was like 2 weeks.
Whoa.
And then, so we started communicating in February. We met in person. And we started talking with a phone in May. And then we met in person in June.
Okay.
And then we got married in November.
Okay.
It was crazy.
Okay.
So we got married in Arizona. And then I just went straight to Omaha.
And you spent your engagement apart?
Yeah. Like, we just went, we travel back and forth. You come here, I go there, you know.
And then when you got married in Arizona.
And then we got on a honeymoon to Hawaii, and then went to Omaha. And I got my hair license out there, so I was doing hair out there, and he was working. And then not too long after that, I was like, I want a baby.
Yeah.
And so I got pregnant.
Yeah.
Like, right, like, yeah. So then I had my first, or we had our first boy.
Did your issues get triggered at all with him?
You know, I told him. Yeah, like, I told him straight up. I was like, you cheat on me, you lie to me, I'm out.
Yeah.
Like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, no excuses, don't screw with me.
Yeah.
End of story.
And then you didn't have any anxiety about it after that?
There was a couple times when I did. There was a couple times in our marriage when I was like, you shut that down right now.
Yeah.
Like, because he had some different jobs where he had, like, women coworkers, and they joke around, like, this is my work wife, my work husband, and I was like, nope. Yeah. And this one time, we were in Utah, and Gray was just a baby, and we had a little vacation in Utah, went to Midway, I think his Matt's parents have a timeshare out there. Mm-hmm. We spent, like, 2 weeks, he was there with us for a week, and then I spent a week there by myself with the kids, and, I remember, like, he was taking a nap on the bed, and I saw his phone. He got a text from this girl, and it was, like, his coworker, and it was, like, none of her business where we were, what we were doing, or how he's doing.
Yeah.
And I read that text, and I was, like...
Wait. The text said...
It was, like...
Like, was asking him?
Too personal. Yeah, it was, like, too personal.
Like, she was, like, asking him how he's doing.
How are you doing? How's your... You know? And I just... I was like,
you don't casual small talk text with a married dude.
No, you don't. And
especially a coworker.
Yeah. I was like, nope. Don't pull that SH ever again. I said, I told you when we got married that I don't, homie, don't play that.
Do you, you think, know what I mean? Do you think that, like, if you had been in the same place that, like, as you were dating, that things like that would have gotten triggered more? Like, I wonder, like, because, I mean, I'm just maybe projecting my own stuff, but, like, I know what my intimacy issues are, and I feel like it's easier for me to do distance because it feels like there's already a buffer. Like, it just feels like my triggers are less available to the relationship because the relationship is already kind of, I don't know. So do you think it would have been different if you were in the same place?
Yeah, I think so.
That's interesting. It's just interesting to think about that.
Yeah.
So while you were dating, these issues didn't come up a ton.
No. No, and that was like, you know, let's see, 6 years into our marriage.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So, anyway, so we had, we had Dallin, and then things were going good. Like, he'd had some different job changes and got, you know, lose jobs, and it was just, like, really stressful. And then I got, so then I had a miscarriage after I had Dallin. He was, like, 9 months old, and I had a miscarriage. And then it was crazy. I was working out with a friend, and she was like, you need to get over here. And I'm like, I am so tired. Like, I just cannot function. And I had also, like, just felt, like, so crappy. And turns out I was pregnant with Jackson. Like, I literally got pregnant 10 days after that miscarriage.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Did you know you were pregnant when you miscarried?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep, I knew I was pregnant. And then got pregnant 10 days later with Jackson. So Dallin and Jackson are 18 months apart.
Wow.
And then Jackson was like a really hard baby. Like, he had really bad reflux. He just cried a lot. So it took me a while to want another baby.
Yeah.
And then we had, I had a total of 4 miscarriages. And all my everything. So I can't remember if it was like, I think I had like 3 in a row. And then I was like, okay, we got to figure out what's going on. Had a bunch of blood work done, and it turns out that I have, like, a gene where my mom had, like, 7 miscarriages, and so it was kind of something passed on to me.
Yeah.
And turns out, like...
Did you know that she had 7 miscarriages?
Yeah. Okay. And that's when they were like, okay, we need to do this testing.
Yeah.
And so then I had Gray, and then we had Heston. So, so we had those 4 little boys, and then,
And how old is Heston now?
Heston will be 5 in June.
Okay.
So Matt got diagnosed. So also, a little story about Matt is he had a really bad back. He broke his back when he was 19. He had like a degenerative disc disease.
Oh.
So he broke his back when he was 19. So he had back surgery. So he'd had some nerve damage in his leg. So he was always on like pain pills. Like, it was always a part of his life. Like, it was just constant pain. And, that was kind of just a part of our life. And it was actually really difficult to deal with because it really put a wrench in a lot of things. Like, let's be honest, sex life.
Right.
Okay. Going out and doing things.
Well, chronic pain, even, like, they affect people's personality. Even,
yeah.
Like.
Yeah. Like, he had really bad anxiety.
Yeah, I was going to say, probably depression. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I'm, like, a very positive. You know what? It's funny, because before Matt died, I, like, just thought depression, anxiety, like, I was such a brat about it. Like, I just had this attitude, like, get over it. Yeah. You know? Like, buck up. Have a good attitude. That is not the case.
Yeah.
So, I learned that after Matt died, that it is definitely a chemical in your body that you need.
Well, it's hard to, like, that's a concept that you almost can't understand.
Until you
can't wrap your head around it. Like, your brain just doesn't have the capacity to understand something like that unless that brain has experienced it. It's like
so true.
It's like you, like how could you have understood?
Yeah,
there's just no way.
I used to get so annoyed, but because it would be like, we'd have plans to go do something with a friend, and he would, you know, back out and had to cancel. Like there are so many things that we didn't do.
Yeah.
Because of his social anxiety, and it made me, because I'm a pretty social person.
Yeah.
Which is funny because now I'm like a extrovert introvert. Mm-hmm. I used to be major extrovert, and now I'm like more introvert extrovert.
Yeah.
But anyway, so
So really fast. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily like the main point of your story, but I do think it's important to touch on, if knowing now, like having a different understanding of anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. Looking back, what would you have done different? Had you had an understanding,
I would have been a lot more compassionate.
So just like when, because this is a question that comes up a lot in this discussion of, mm-hmm. like, what do you do? Like, if there's someone who like is canceling plans, like, do you still encourage them to come out?
I mean,
like, at what point are you enabling them?
I don't
know,
because, like, then I didn't know, and I would just get mad and frustrated, you know? But now that I understand it, it's like, I would be, like, compassionate, and I'd be like, yeah. You know what? Do what you gotta do.
Yeah.
You know? You do you. You do what you gotta do.
Yeah.
To feel better. Take your time.
Yeah.
I have a completely different attitude about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think also just, like, going through losing him, I have a completely different perspective on it. Just how to treat people.
Right.
Yeah. You know? But, anyway, so where were we? We're talking about...
So, he had...
Oh, yeah. So, this is how it all happened with the cancer. So, he had a canker sore on his tongue. And he kind of let it go for a while, and he would go to the dentist and be like, I got this canker sore, and he would just give him, like, antibiotic. And then it started hurting his jaw and his head and his neck. And so he finally went and got a biopsy done. Like, he went back to the dentist, and the dentist is like, you know what, I don't know. We'll have you go to a specialist. And they took a little biopsy, and the doctor was like, you know, it's probably an ulcer, but it could be cancer. But it's probably an ulcer.
Yeah.
A little, don't really worry about it. So they took a little chunk of it, and the doctor called 2 days later. He's like, we'll let you know in a couple weeks. He called 2 days later. And he said, you have stage 3 squamous cell carcinoma.
Stage 3.
So.
Where was stage 1 and 2?
I don't even know. So for the longest time.
It was just a canker sore. Mm-hmm. Still at that point, right? Like it was hurting more places. But
yeah,
it was
hurting
just
his neck and his jaw. Yeah. And the thing is, it didn't even look like anything. It just looked like nothing alarming.
Yeah.
But for the longest time, because this is why I brought up the pain addiction thing, is that he had taken this pain medication to help him get off the pain pills. I forget what it's called, but it was like a strip. And he'd have to, like, put it on the back of his tongue. And so we thought that's
just, like,
where
a
the
side effect.
We thought that's what it was, but it wasn't. I mean, that was kind of ruled out.
Yeah.
So then he got in touch with a head and neck cancer doctor, and they had, like, the whole cancer team. So he had to actually see an ENT that was on the cancer board. And they're like, okay, we're going to go in and just take out the tongue, like part of the tongue. And so they took out 30% of the tongue, which sounds like a lot, but really it's not. Like, it was like the back side of his tongue. So, which was good, because otherwise they had to do reconstruction, which is pretty horrible. I have a dear friend who had to have her tongue reconstructed. It's awful.
Jeez.
But anyway, so he had to have the 30% of his tongue removed. They did that, and then they took out, like, 45 lymph nodes and then a tumor in his neck. So, like, okay, because usually with this type of cancer, they're like, take out the cancer and you're good to go. Like, it was a really, really high survival rate. And then we found out a few weeks later that there was one positive lymph node. They're like, we're so sorry, but you got to do radiation. But before the radiation, we got to take out all your teeth. Because any old dental work, gone. Because then if you do the radiation, you could potentially lose your jaw. The teeth will just, like, loosen up and you just lose your... It's just everything kind of collapses. So you have all this dental... So he had to have 10 teeth extracted, like all the bottom, back, and top. all the those teeth were extracted. And then he went through the radiation and did 37 rounds of radiation on his face. And
37?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lot?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know anything
about that. He had to go, like, every day, a couple times a week. Jeez. It was like a summer. It was like that summer of 2016. So Heston was just a baby. And so he finished the radiation, like, in August. And then the radiation stays in your body for 3 months. So once that radiation was out, they went and they did a scan to see if they got everything. And then he had to go back in January for, like, that next scan to see it, if it was all good. And the doctor looked in his mouth and he was like, "You're good. You need to come back. You look fine." And we're both like, "Aren't you supposed to come back like every 3 months?" And
yeah,
you know. And so we both felt like that was weird. So we went and found a different doctor to do like this kind of a second opinion. And the doctor was like, "Yeah, we got to do a whole full scan." And that's when they found the mass in his lungs.
Why would that doctor say that?
I know. And after that, we had a friend at the time who lost her husband. It was actually a malpractice lawsuit, and so she...
That doctor?
It was a different... It was her... My friend's husband thought he had, like, food poisoning and was, like, super sick. They took him to the ER and just throwing up and just so ill, and they sent him home. And Missy, my friend, she was a nurse. She's like, "I swear he has spinal meningitis." And the doctor's like, "No." And turns out that that's what he had. And the doctor went back and changed the records. And he died in the ER that weekend. And she sued him.
Oh, so my gosh.
The lawyer she used, she's like, "You got to call this guy. He will totally help you guys and see if you guys have a case." So we talked to that lawyer. Matt and I met with him. And they're like, "Hey, we'll see what we have." So then in the meantime, we find out that the cancer is... in his lungs. So, well, before they found out it was in his lungs, they were just like kind of, he had pneumonia. That was the thing. He's like, "Probably just the pneumonia, but there is like something in your lungs."
Yeah.
So they would like x-ray it and it kept getting bigger. They're like, "Okay, we got to go in, take you to a pulmonologist." And then they're like, "We're going to treat it like cancer until we prove that it's not."
Yeah.
So went in and had a biopsy done of his lung. And they said, "Okay, after the biopsy, if you have a hard time breathing at all, go to the ER. That's like a big side effect of having your lung biopsied is like having a hard time breathing. So just go to the ER." He did. So we took him to the ER. And I remember being at the pulmonologist and we noticed he had like this lump on his neck. And I was like, "Your body's probably just like pissed at you because you've been through so much." And I remember we were sitting in the doctor's office and Matt had this attitude like, "I beat cancer once, I can do it again." Yeah. And so we're like, you know, like in Lion King, "I laugh at the face of danger. Ha ha ha." Right. I'm like, we're like, "We laugh at the face of cancer. Ha ha ha." Uh-huh. Like, "We got this. Like, this is no big deal. You did it once, we'll do it again," you know? So then he had a hard time breathing. So he went to the ER and this lump on his neck. So I said, "Hey, you know what? He's got this lump. Will you guys just take a look at it?" So they did a extra, like a little ultrasound of it. Turns out he had a blood clot from his elbow up to his neck.
One clot?
A huge blood clot. And it was just like this. It was just bad. So they admitted him right away for the blood clot and the pneumonia. So that's what he was being treated for. So then he would like, so he got, and he was like.
How did he not have a heart attack?
It was not that was not that vein. It was like, rather than being in a major artery, it was just like.
Some random vein?
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah. So no wonder he had these, like, debilitating headaches, because he wasn't getting enough oxygen to his brain, and it was just, like, the major cause of all of his headaches. He's having these really bad headaches. So he's in the hospital, and he started out being, like, what's, like, the stage below, ICU? PINS. They call it the PINS unit.
Oh.
And so he was in there, and then he'd get better, he'd get worse, like, this whole, like, back-and-forth thing. And then about...
How long was he there?
3 weeks.
Wow.
So 2 weeks into the stay, we find out, like, we had met with the doctors and they come in. And they're like, "Well, I'm not actually his doctor. I'm not specialized in this, but, you know, let's go ahead and get the chemo started." So we were going to start the chemo. So this is on a Wednesday, and that morning we talked to palliative care because at this point he was in the ICU. And he would like, this one, I remember this one time, it was like Easter Sunday, and we're at the hospital and his body just started shutting down. And he was like, Matt's dad was like, he's probably not going to make it. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Took him to ICU, and then he miraculously, like, they were going to do dialysis. They ended up not having to do that. He just came out of it. And then, so, like, that couple days later was a Wednesday, and they talked to palliative care, which is kind of like hospice. And they were, like, giving us our options. Like, we can start the chemo, or we can take him to a hospice house. We don't know if he's going to make it over to hospice house. And so I'm, like, I remember talking to the lady and just going through my phone and just trying to find as many pictures as I can. And just finding pictures and just screenshotting picture, picture, picture. Just trying to find as many pictures and videos that I can. And my friend Meg was in town. She lived in Missouri. She still does. She came from Missouri to help out with the kids, and she had the most genius idea to go to Build-A-Bear and record Matt's voice and these little bears for each boy.
Wow.
So that was like, that has been my saving grace this last few years, is for those boys to listen to that, his voice in the bear. It's like a special message for each boy.
Wow.
So that day we talked to palliative care, and then we're like, let's just talk to the doctor and see what he has to say about this. The doctor's like, listen, So 2 weeks into the hospital stay, that his actual doctor comes in and he's like, he got the port put in to get the chemo started. We were like, all right, let's do this. Let's get this party started. Let's get him better. Let's get him home. And the doctor comes in. He was very somber. And we're like, I thought we were supposed to be like happy.
Yeah.
We're going to get this going. And he's like, I'm sorry, but there's no point in doing it. We're worried about his quality of life than quantity, because he's not going to make it. He has like 3 to 6 months. And so in my mind, I thought, okay, let's get him better, get him home, go on a sweet trip with the kids, make some memories, and, you know, do it that way. That was in my mind, and Matt as well. So then we talked to the doc. So then,
And he's like awake at this point. Like,
yeah.
He's like,
yeah. And I remember at this point, then he was just like, pissed.
That was?
Oh, yeah. He was mad. He was really mad. Because he just has to process all this.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not going to see my kids. I'm not going to live.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, looking back and thinking, like, gosh, what has... Because he internalized... He, like, was also on a lot of pain pills because... Or not just medication, because cancer is very painful. And his lungs were filling up with fluid. Like, they had drained the fluid out of his lungs, and the next day would be filled up again. Like, they'd fill out, like, these liter and a half of fluid. It was like he was just drowning. It was awful.
So, on top of everything else.
On top of everything else, yeah. So you can't breathe, and you feel like you're suffocating, and then knowing you're going to die. It's awful. So the doctor, so this went particular Wednesday. So it was exactly a week later. So the doctor comes in, talks to us, tells us he's going to die later, 3 to 6 months. Exactly a week later, we meet with palliative care. Doctor comes in that night, and he was like, we can start the chemo, but it's not going to do anything, you know? So we wait for the doctor to leave, and we all were, like, kind of discussing amongst, and Matt was, like, asleep, like, the whole day.
Who's we all?
His parents, his sister, and his brother. His sister came in from Nebraska, from Utah. And then this was me, his parents, his brother, and sister.
And you're in Nebraska.
And we're in Nebraska. So we're all sitting there, and Matt was asleep all day, totally out of it. And so we're discussing, like, what do we do? Do we do the chemo? Do we not? And so Matt's mom was like, no, I'm sick and tired of seeing him poked and prodded and, you know, going through all this.
It's not going to save him.
It's not going to save him. And me and Matt's dad were like, well... It's going to give us more time, you know?
Yeah.
So then, literally, we're sitting there talking, and Matt sits up out of nowhere, and he says, are my eyes fixed and dilated? And we're like, no. He's like, then let me fight. Okay. All right, let's let you fight. Let's do this. So then He's in the ICU at this point. So then we, his parents leave, his brother and sister leave, and I had a sitter at the house, and I was like, there was a, at this time, the show Schitt's Creek had just been like, it was like the best. Mm-hmm. So we would just watch it, and I try and get him to like engage and laugh, and he just was so, he was just had to have been in his own
like emotionally or emotionally, physically?
Both, but more probably even more emotionally, just I can't even imagine what he was feeling. But
did he still look like himself at this point?
Yeah, he had gotten pretty skinny from when he found out he had to have his teeth extracted. When he started radiation, he gained like 30 pounds. He's like, I'm gonna eat.
Yeah,
and eat because when he did the radiation, he lost all of his taste buds.
Oh, geez.
So he. Food tasted like nothing.
Oh my gosh, so sad.
So he got pretty skinny, but not like, I mean, it was definitely the skinniest he ever been, but not, he didn't look like unhealthy.
Yeah,
you know. So
did they give him like dentures or something, or did he
he had these front ones right here and right here, and that was it. I mean, he probably would have if he, you know.
Right.
But I used to, so this one time we were in radiation at this appointment, and I see this older man who had had the same thing. So, like, he had, like, these things, like, hanging down from his throat because, like, I think it's, I don't know if it was, like, his thyroid or something, like, right here. And it was, like two testicles.
Like, right under his chin.
Right under his chin. And I was like, if that happens to you, I'm out. I'm leaving you.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was like, I don't blame you. But anyways, that was just funny.
I'm trying to picture that in my head.
It was okay, saggy and like this like balls.
Like hanging from his jaw.
Yeah.
Weird.
It was so weird. And I was like,
don't do that.
Nope. Yeah. That happens, I'm out.
Yep.
But anyway, so that night, I like, all right, love you. I'm going to go to bed. And he's like, all right, love you. Told the nurse, like, if anything happens, call me. And he always felt like he'd call his dad before he called me because his dad's a physician. And so I went home, and I am one of those weirdos that goes to sleep with my phone on silent because I don't like being bugged in my sleep. Uh-huh. So my phone was on silent, but it was still, like, on vibrate. So I was like...
Did you have a hard time leaving him at night? Or at that point, was it just... Normal.
It was just normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I just, my routine was go stay there at the hospital. Like, we kind of take shifts, like,
yeah.
Be with the kids and then find someone to watch the kids, go to the hospital.
Yeah.
Like, it was just this routine, right. You know, and I would sleep there a lot.
How often did the kids go to the hospital?
You know what? Actually, it got to the point where he didn't want them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because he's like, I don't want them to see me like this.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point where I'm like, you know what? They need to see you.
Yeah.
And so, actually, I can post the video of what would be their last hug.
Did they know?
No.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. I'll post the video on the page. It's just so tender.
Yeah.
But, so that night, I went to bed, and I woke up with my phone buzzing, and it was Matt's dad, and he's like, you get to the hospital right now. He's not going to make it. And I just, it was like a punch in the gut, and I just...
And you had, like, planned a trip, right? You were, like, planning a trip.
Well, no. Like, that was just in the thought. This is only a week later.
Oh, yeah.
This is a week later. So, I did not
see this happen. But it was, like, in the thought process. Yeah. Like, this is what you thought was going
to
happen.
Yeah, what I thought was going to happen was that he would go to chemo. He would do chemo. He'd get better. We get him home. Go on a trip.
And then enjoy
the time. And then enjoy the time we had with him.
Right.
And then that would be it.
Right.
No. Didn't work out that way. It was a week later, he dies. So, I get to the hospital. And I called my friend Mary. And I said, I need you to come to the house. I got to go to the hospital. Matt's dying. And I remember looking in my fridge, and the last thing I saw was that quote by Jeffrey R. Holland says, heaven is cheering you on today, tomorrow, and forever. That was the last thing I saw. And I drive like a bat out of hell to that hospital. I call my mom, just like hyperventilating. Like, I just couldn't even breathe.
She was here.
She was here in Arizona. I call her on the phone. I'm like, Mom, he's dying. And she was just in tears, and... get to the hospital, and the nurse is like, okay, this is the end of life procedure. She's like, well, first, she said, gave us the option. She's like, he can continue like this for like up to a week. So he was basically drowning you know,
the pneumonia,
the fluid in his lungs is all just cancer.
Yeah.
And so, and he couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, he can go on like this for like a week, or you can just turn off the machines and let him go.
And he's awake? Is he at this point, like, is he...
He was not even conscious. Like, he, and at this point, he couldn't, he had no control over his bladder.
But he was conscious when you had left that night, right?
Yeah. And kind of. But not really talking.
Yeah.
But just, like, looked at me. Like, you know, I remember looking at me, and I gave him a kiss, you know? But I didn't think.
Right.
You know? So... The nurse was like, she was so sweet. And she's like, okay, this is your option. You can let him kind of basically suffer and drown to death.
Yeah.
Over a week's time. Or just turn off the machines and let him go. And they gave him medicine to, like, so he didn't feel any pain. And so that's what we did. And it was like, I don't even know. I feel like it was like hours, but I don't even know. And he just, like, slowly... body just shut down, and he would, I don't know if anyone has been around someone who dies, but it's kind of horrible.
Yeah.
It's not as, like, some people say it's so spiritual, but I don't know.
Think it depends, but, like, at that point, even though he had been given, like, a life expectancy, it was way longer than you thought. So I think that it's different when it catches you so off guard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you going home thinking that you have 3 to 6 months, and then hours later getting a phone call and having to watch death in that moment.
Yeah.
I think there's something that's really jarring about that. I think that's... It makes it really hard.
Yeah, so... So it was just like you'd think that he was gone, and he'd go, oh, and like gasp for air. And it was like that for a while. And then, like, at one point, he sat up and he grabbed me and he just hugged me. He, like, dug his hands into my shoulders and just hugged me so tight. And just that he had this look of, like, being so scared. And I just looked at him and I said, it's going to be okay. We're going to be okay. And I said, give those babies a hug for me. Love them. Love on them. So we're going to be okay. And he just looked at me in the eyes of just, like, this sadness and this fear. He laid down. He was gone.
What do you think the fear...
I think the fear of...
Fear for you.
Fear for me.
The kids.
The, you know, not knowing what... You know, how we're going to be, how we're going to do life without him.
Right.
You know?
Not having had really and the just time the, to figure just it out.
Just the fear of, like, of just that being scared of, like, dying and just, like, life and death.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you think of, like, I mean, just psychologically, a man understands his value based on how he can provide for his family. And in that moment, understanding that his family is about to go through hell, like the hardest thing they possibly could go through, and that he can't, not only can he not protect his family from that, but like
provide for them,
he can't help them get through it either.
Yeah.
Like, not really. I mean, in his own way, in a different way, but not in the way that he would want to.
You know, something else I want to bring up. I remember, like, before he died, he was in the hospital, and my sister's best friend Tina is she's a therapist. She's actually a doctor. She's got a doctorate. She's a therapist. And she was a professor anyway. So she's amazing. And so he felt very comfortable talking to her. And I remember, like during this whole time of this hospital process, and, like, even just before he was in the hospital, people were just being so good to us and taking care of us, coming to clean my house, doing my laundry, taking care of the kids, you know, so much love and kindness that, like, it was just, I felt this immense amount of gratitude and joy. And I'm the kind of person where, like, I have to try and find the good in the situation. That's just who I am. And so when Matt was going through all of this, I had to find the good in it. And the good was all the good that people are doing for our family and loving us and taking care of us and rallying around us. And just, it was just amazing. This beautiful feeling that I've never felt before.
Transcendent.
Yes. And so I just remember thinking, like, this is so awful, but I also know I'm being taken care of.
Right.
In many ways.
Yeah.
You know? And I just remember being like, okay, you know what? I can do hard things. I can do hard things. I can do this. Like, we've dealt with this. I can do this. You know, I felt like this unexplainable, like, strength. I can't even explain where it came from, but I had this strength and this courage that it was going to be okay.
Grace.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so I also remember, so he, you know, he takes his last breath and they, you know, take the pulse and he's gone. And the thing that was the most beautiful thing is a look on his face was this peace. Because he'd always had like this like pain. He always had back pain, the nerve pain, and then the cancer, and the just, he dealt with so much pain for his whole life.
Right.
That like he just looked just so peaceful. And it was a beautiful thing to see that peace. Finally, yeah. Pain-free.
Yeah.
And that was very comforting. But I remember, so we left the hospital. I looked back and I remember thinking, it's just a body. It's his spirit, who he is in heaven.
Yeah, it's just weird. A body. It's and weird, the unattachment that happens almost instantly.
And it's like it dawned on me, like, what's important in life is not, it's who we love. It's how we love.
Yeah.
It's how we treat others. That's what we take with us to heaven. It's not the things. It's not the house. It's not the car. It's not the career. It's how you treat and love others, and you need to be there for people. And that was one thing that was so amazing during the whole experience, was people who were just so good to the boys and I. And that changed me. Like, I feel like when you go through any sort of loss, mm-hmm. it changes you for good. And you just, you see people differently, and you have a different sort of compassion, and then you just have this desire to connect with people, and you want to know, like, you know what? Like, I want to shout from the rooftops, like, you know what? Life sucks and life is hard, but guess what? We can be there for each other and rally each other on and be there for each other.
Yeah.
So anyway, so then we left the hospital. I had to come home and I couldn't sleep, and I had to thinking, how do I tell the boys? How do I tell them that their dad is in heaven? But I just kept thinking, because my friend Missy, who I told you guys about earlier, who lost her husband, her son Sam, sweetest boy. So he knew how the boys felt, you know, and that was one thing that their family was so good to us. Like, they watched the boys. They were just constantly there for us. And she knew, she's remarried. And so she knew kind of like what I'd been through and what I was going to be going through, and then she was just so good. But I remember thinking, okay, the boys were friends with Sam for a reason. And so I just said to the boys, I said, you know what? They woke up to go to school, and so I had to tell them, you know, Dad's in heaven. And I said, you know how Sam's dad died? And he said, yeah. I said, they're together. They're going to be buddies in heaven. And Dad gets to, you know, help him learn about, you know, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so I said, okay, boys, what would Dad want to do? You know, how can we celebrate Dad? And so they said, he'd want to go to the movies. Great. Let's do it. Went and saw Boss Baby. That just came out. Saw Boss Baby. What do you want to eat? He wanted to have nachos. So we had nachos. So that whole day, we just did everything that Dad would want to do and celebrate as much as we could. And so, anyway, so that's, I mean, that was probably the most difficult thing out of the whole situation, was telling the boys, you know, that they didn't have a dad, that he passed. And And that in that moment just kind of hit me that I have to, you know, figure this out. That I have to, you know, be both mommy and dad and just help them through life. So they handle it so well. They've been such brave, good boys, and they have their moments. They have their struggles. They miss their dad every single day. But I'm so proud of what good, strong boys they are. But anyway, so,
how long has it been?
It'll be 3 years in April. Sorry.
No apologizing allowed. I have a question.
Sure.
What do you do with your boys to, like, how do you encourage them to continue to have a relationship with him? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. How do you keep him present? In what ways, you know, because you date now, you date,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so,
yeah.
How have you navigated keeping him present and relevant, but also being able to, like, keep necessary boundaries? And
well, we have photos, you know, we have a picture of me and the boys, and we're holding a picture of Matt, and we have our family picture that we had before he died, and then the boys have a picture of him by their bed, and they have their bears that they listen to his voice, and we talk about him in random conversation, you know, like, he's...
Were you able to do that right away?
Yeah, you know what? So,
like, you talk, like, the way you talk about it now, I mean, it's been 3 years, almost four, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? Is that what you said?
It'll be 3 years in
April. Almost three.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't seem... I don't know. I just... People deal with it differently, and I know some people don't like to talk about...
Yeah.
...their losses at all. They don't... But you, ever since I have met you, you've been very
open about... I'm very open about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember, like, years ago, we lived in Omaha, and Down was in preschool, and there was a teacher who had this, you know, like, when someone passes away, and it says, has her name on there, and, like, the dates on their car, you know?
Yeah.
And so, his teacher, so I didn't know whose car that was, it just had the kid's name and the date, and he was little, and so, this one day, we had parent-teacher conferences, and she starts talking about her son, and I was like, oh, okay, how old is he? She's like, oh, no, he passed away. And there was a couple years ago, there were some Boy Scouts that were killed in a tornado. And it was like in Iowa. No, South Dakota. Whatever. It's, I don't even know. Sioux Falls. I don't know. It's this little Boy Scout
place.
And these, like, Boy Scouts were all, like, there was, I think he was one of the only kids that died, but a lot of them got hurt really bad. Anyway, so it was her son. Jeez. And she's like, oh, he would be like, you know, whatever now. And I just was so amazed at how she talked about him as if he was still alive.
Yeah.
And that...
Still relevant.
And still relevant and still a part of her life.
Right.
You know? And so, I don't know, like, then that, in that sense, it kind of prepared me, you know? So, like...
That was before Matt died.
That was before... That was when Dallin was just little. He was, like, he was, like, three or four. And I would think about that all the time. You know, just like, wow, like, she talked about this, her son, and, like, he's still alive. And then you talk to her, you're like... Yeah. And then you feel, like... bad, because you don't really, then you realize, oh my gosh, he passed away, and then you realize that he's the boy that was one of the Boy Scouts, and you just can't even believe it. But so that kind of, like, stuck with me for a long time, and so I never want his memory to go away. I don't ever want them to ever forget their dad.
Right.
And so we talk about him all the time.
Yeah.
Like, he's a part of our conversation, you know.
And it doesn't feel heavy. That's
no,
the other thing.
It doesn't.
Like, when you bring him up, like, there's always a part of me that's, like anticipating some heavy feeling. Because that happens a lot.
Yeah.
Like, in those conversations, you bring up the person who died or the loss, and, like, there's, like, a heavy air, but it never comes.
Well, you want to know why? It's because I remember planning his funeral. So, we're sitting at the mortuary. Oh, another thing. So, when I had to go to the mortuary and, like, get him, like, dressed, because he was in the hospital gown, I had to put clothes on him. And his hair looks so ugly. And I'm a hairstylist. So I was like, I cut his hair. at the mortuary.
Good for you.
So I cut his hair and styled it the way that it should, and I trimmed his beard. He looked really good. And so we had to plan the funeral, and I remember, like, thinking, you know what? Like, Matt was, like, this fun, as much as he had, like, had struggles with anxiety and depression, he was really fun and funny, and we just had, he was, like, my best friend. Like, I don't even know how to explain our relationship, but I just knew that I wanted his funeral to be fun, because that's who he was. So we had his dad told really fun, like, great stories about when he was little, and then his two best friends got up and spoke and shared some really, people were, like, laughing at this funeral because we were just, the stories were hilarious.
Yeah.
And so that kind of set the tone for how we celebrate him.
Yeah.
Is by, because he would not want us to be, like, sad and cry and be depressed and, like, not be able to move forward. He would want us to celebrate him,
yeah,
and laugh and remember the good,
right?
You know, and so I've never made it be sad. Like, if my boys are sad, you know, something I learned from Carrie, I went back to her after I moved back here from Omaha. I was like, we got to go back to Carrie, and she taught me something, because, like, when the boys would be really sad, I would try and be like, it's okay, it's gonna be okay, you know. You know, try and find the good and try to be positive. And she was like, you know what? No, let them be sad. Let them be mad.
Yeah.
Let them sit in it for a minute.
Yeah.
And then move forward.
Right.
And so I've learned that. So when they're mad, I let them be mad. Let them be angry. You know, punch your pillow. Do what you got to do. And then move from that and move forward.
Yeah.
You know?
Because true optimism isn't the lack of negativity, really, right, of any kind of negativity. Mm-hmm. True optimism can only exist if there is pain. You know what I mean? Optimism, in its truest, most fulfilling form, is because there are difficult, hard, painful things, and choosing to see the light anyway, but it doesn't work unless you have to fully acknowledge the things that are weighing you down first, and sit in it for a second, so that when you do choose the positivity, when you're ready,
then you can find that joy.
It's fully it's fulfilling rather than just, like, it's not necessarily, I don't know, like, it's not, it's a coping deeper mechanism. Yeah. It, it's like, it actually fulfills something. Yes. It's not just a band-aid that you're putting to, like, you know, instead of, it's not instead of the pain.
Right.
It's with the pain. Right. It's complementary. And,
so, that was kind of, like, my whole mantra was, like, finding joy. And, like, you can still find joy in sadness. Like, even after he died, you know, I for a while I felt guilty for, like, being able to be happy and being able to find joy. Because I'm like, I shouldn't, like, I felt, like, guilty or bad. And then I'm like, no, like, it's okay to, like, be sad and then still find joy in certain things, you know? And so that was a challenge for me in the very beginning, because I just, I don't know, people, like, expected me to be, like, sad all the time.
Yeah.
But that's not who I am.
Right.
You know? I'm not a sad person. Like, I have my sad moments.
Right.
And I have my moments when I fall apart.
Right.
But also, but for the most part, I try and, you know, find the joy in situations and this situation.
Do you feel like being able to communicate about it and talk about him openly has at all affected your ability to still find the joy? Like, do you feel like they're related at all? Like, I would think that, I mean, if you don't ever talk about it and you're treating it like a secret, I just feel like it would be hard to.
Yeah.
I think it would make the joy even more confusing, especially for your kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would be like, I don't know.
I mean, like, when they have, like, when they have their moments, like, it's usually Dallin, my oldest.
How old is he?
He's 11.
Okay.
But you know what? It's like the little things, like, you know, it was really hard for him to be, like, involved in sports.
Yeah.
Because he would see these dads there. Or going, like, where did we go? We went somewhere. And he just, oh, my friend, my best friend got him tickets to the Harlem Globetrotters. And they had, and she got, like, the whole package where they could, like, go, like, play basketball on the court with them. Wow. And, like, shoot hoops and stuff and the whole thing. And he got back and I was like, Jeff Bunn? He was like, yeah. And I could tell he was sad. I'm like, why are you sad? He's like, there were just so many dads there. And I was the only one without a dad. And so in those moments, I let him just be sad and just, like, you know, try and, like, you know what? Yeah, you're right, buddy. It does. It is hard. There were probably a lot of dads.
Yeah.
You know, and so I tried to try and validate him more rather than like try and like push it away. Like, it's going to be okay.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I try and like validate him.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so, yeah, so like about like that whole, I would say those first like 6 months were like a blur. But then that 6 month mark, like around Christmas time, is when I thought I was gonna lose my shizola.
Yeah.
Like, I remember at Christmas break, I text my best friend, I was like, I feel like I wanna run away and never come back. And I feel like I hate everybody and I'm constantly annoyed, constantly frustrated. I feel like I'm not only drowning, but I feel like I'm being buried alive and there's no light. I just feel like I'm suffocating. And she was like, you need to go to the doctor. I was like, you're probably right.
Yeah.
And so that's when I went to my OB, and she was like, girl, I don't know why you didn't get help sooner. She put me on something along with counseling.
Yeah.
And that, like, completely helped me. And that was kind of when I was like, okay, I get this feeling of, like, being completely helpless,
yeah,
and being completely out of control. Like, you feel like you're not yourself, you know?
Yeah.
I felt like I wasn't myself. And right. Now when I'm on my medication, it's like, I feel like I'm me again.
Yeah. I feel like people, especially people who experience like really intense loss like this, they like feel like it's cheating or something to like you, but like there are resources available for this. Yes. And it's not cheating.
No, it is getting the help you need. And there is no shame. There is nothing wrong with getting medical help. Whether it's counseling or just doing what you have to do to, you know, and getting on medication. Like,
right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Right. So now moving forward and getting mm-hmm. your message out
mm-hmm.
to the world with mm-hmm. this platform that mm-hmm. you've created, what is the most important thing that you want people to understand?
I want people to know that that you have a voice, that I just feel like it's so important to share like the good and the bad and the ugly and be vulnerable. So because when you're vulnerable, like, you just connect.
Yes.
And I want people to know that they can connect. Like, I want people to
know. It's the only way to connect.
And I want people to know that, like, you can always, I will always be someone's sounding board.
Yeah.
I want people to know that they can always, there's someone to talk to. Like,
yeah.
Find your person who you, like, I have a lot of family and friends, but my very bestest friend, I can tell her anything and say anything and never feel judged.
Yeah.
So find that person. I'll be your person. Yeah, I'll be that person.
There's room at the table.
There's room at the table. Like, yeah. Come to my table.
Yep.
And I'll be your sounding board. I will, you know, I want everybody to know that, like, I just want people to feel included and feel loved and feel like they have, you know, just like a little army of people who support you.
Yeah.
Because I had that when I was going through all that. You know?
Yeah.
And I just want people to feel, like, loved and cared for and...
So, last question then.
Mm-hmm.
How, the other way, how would you advise someone to, be available or to spread that love to other people? Like, what's the best advice you have as far as loving another person? What can we do to make the people around us feel
share
love and safe?
I think you have to, I think you have to share. Be like, it's scary. to be open and to be vulnerable. But I feel like if you take that leap of faith and just, you know, if you have, find your one person who you feel safe with and share that. And then you, I just know, like, you know, if you can just, you know, share something, then you can, that person can, you know, connect with you and be like, oh, you know what? I went through something kind of similar. I, when I was this, or, you know, I just, I feel like just take that, that leap of faith to just be vulnerable and share and find your one person that you feel like you can talk to. And then, and be that person. And be that person.
Learn
that
you can, compassion.
Learn compassion. Compassion is so huge.
If you're not good at it, get good at it.
Because you can, it's something that can be taught. And learned.
Well, we appreciate that you're willing to share your story so openly and provide a platform for other people to do the same thing. And, you know, a safe place for them to. And for people to come in and draw from that strength that other people have found in their own experiences. So, I'm glad I got to be part of it for a day.
Well, thank you.
For a day or so.
Well, thank you for being here. And just, this is Holly Bessie. And remember, there's always room at my table.